Welcome to Hub Headlines. Today's program features the best commentary and analysis published in the Hub for March 25th. Up first is Livio Di Matteo writing on why we can't bet on low interest rates returning anytime soon.
With inflation subsiding and poised to fall below 3% in 2024, and an economy that is slowing but not in recession, the Bank of Canada's monetary policy of interest rate increases over the last 2 years appears to have successfully engineered a soft landing for the economy. Unemployment remains below 6%, wage growth appears to be slowing, and while GDP growth in 2023 was anemic, there were no two consecutive quarters of negative growth, meaning Canada averted a technical recession. As the post-pandemic inflationary surge subsides, discussion has turned to the question of rate cuts to end the pain that has been caused particularly to mortgage holders and other borrowers. While the higher interest rates that Canadians have endured are low relative to the rates of the 1980s or 1990s, they are being felt harshly given that the decade prior to this increase saw some of the lowest rates in recent Canadian economic history. Calls for lowering interest rates have most recently come from the Premier of Ontario, as well as economists. There are really two separate questions to consider with respect to interest rate policy in Canada. First, should interest rates come down? Second, when should they come down? Indeed, even in the face of stubbornly core inflation and inflationary wage expectations, economists Jeremy Cronick and Steve Ambler have made the case for a rate cut by the Bank of Canada in April. Their argument hinges on the notable decline in inflation once more volatile components of the main CPI are stripped out, as well as the growing weakness of GDP growth going into 2024, notwithstanding the successful soft landing of 2023. Given that the U.S. economy has performed even more robustly than Canada's in the face of interest rate increases, much will depend on when the U.S. Federal Reserve begins to start cutting its rates. Ultimately, our central bank rate and interest rates in general will not get too far out of line with American ones, given that our economy is heavily integrated with the U.S., while it is anticipated that the U.S. Fed will begin reducing interest rates in 2024. Something made even more likely one suspects by the prospect of an election in November. It is unlikely it will cut rates before April, given that even Chair Jerome Powell has said it is unlikely to occur. All of this aside, the overarching question facing Canadians is where can we expect interest rates to settle down at once victory has been declared on the war against inflation? Here we can draw some insight from the long-term performance of the Bank of Canada rate and the Canadian economy since the taming of the last great inflationary surge of the 1970s and 1980s. The period since 1990 represents a distinct economic era from pre-1990, given that it was marked by the taming of inflationary expectations and economic liberalization via trade agreements and globalization that sparked a new era of growth for the Canadian economy. This was also the era that saw the Bank of Canada adopt the 2% inflation target. Evidence from this era may provide an indication of where the bank rate is going to settle down at. The accompanying figure uses Federal Reserve economic data from the St. Louis Fed to plot monthly data from 1990 to 2023 for three variables: the CPI inflation rate, the central bank rate, and the unemployment rate. These variables are all related when it comes to monetary policy, given that restrictive monetary policy designed to slow the economy down and bring down the rate of inflation would also be correlated with a rising unemployment rate. Along with the monthly variable plots, what has also been plotted is the average for each variable over the 1990 to 2023 period. The resulting averages are striking. First, inflation over this period has indeed averaged 2%. At the same time, it has been accompanied by an average central bank rate of 4% and an average unemployment rate of 8%. Notwithstanding fluctuations and short-term trends, on average during this period, the central bank rate has been approximately twice that of the inflation rate and the unemployment rate double the bank rate. Put another way, to keep inflation at about 2%, you need a bank rate of 4% and sufficient slack in the labor market, resulting in an 8% unemployment rate. On the one hand, a 2-4-8 rule summarizing a longer-term empirical relationship between inflation, the bank rate, and the unemployment rate may seem like an arbitrary, exceedingly simplistic, and coincidental relationship. On the other hand, we are currently at 3% inflation, 5% bank rate, and 6% unemployment, suggesting that relative to the long-term average performance, there is still substantial inflationary pressure in the Canadian economy. To bring us down to 2% inflation may require the bank rate to stay higher for longer than many would like. More to the point, the accompanying figure suggests the ultra-low interest rates of the last decade are indeed an aberration. Those expecting the bank rate to go back down to 1% once declines begin are in for a big shock. Indeed, even the Bank of Canada is on the record stating that the very low rates from 2008 to 2009 are unlikely to return and will lead to a world where they are higher than we have grown accustomed to. However, if you need empirical evidence based on historical averages from even before 1990, a bank rate of 4% is probably a realistic expectation of what the future will bring.
That was a commentary by Livio Di Matteo. He is a professor of economics at Lakehead University. You can find the full text of his article on our website, thehub.ca.
Hi, Hub Podcast listener. Fun fact to share with you. Well, not really. This year, most major newspapers in Canada will join the CBC and fund the majority of their journalists' salaries through one form of government-coordinated subsidy or another. Here at The Hub, we think this is bad for journalism and bad for news consumers like you. This is why The Hub is not availing itself of these government subsidies. But producing high-quality, independent news and analysis is expensive and time-consuming. This is why we are asking you now to become a Hub subscriber for as little as 25 cents a day. Get all kinds of great benefits, including subscriber-only analysis of the economy and politics, podcast content, and so much more, all with the knowledge that your support makes our independent journalism possible. Join at thehub.ca.
Our second essay is by Ginny Roth, writing on why Pierre Poilievre continues to confound the media.
As an avid consumer of wonky right-of-center new media content, I'm always eager to receive my daily email from The Line. I read it after the Hub newsletter, but I enjoy it nonetheless. So when I saw last week that the chronically reasonable Matt Gurney had published under his own byline, I eagerly opened the email, and when I saw the headline, "What I Got Wrong About Poilievre," I was practically salivating. As I began reading, my mind leapt back to a little more than 2 years ago to February 1, 2022. The trucker convoy had swept into Ottawa, Aaron O'Toole's leadership of the Conservative Party of Canada was hanging on by a thread, and some Canadian political blowhards were drinking wine at 10 p.m. on a YouTube livestream, talking about what would happen next. There were several guests who joined and left throughout the night, and while there were various points of agreement and disagreement, one thing was clear. When it came to empathizing with the trucker convoy and finding a new party leader, I was out on my own. It wasn't that the hosts and other guests thought O'Toole was doing so great, it was just that they were deeply and incredibly concerned about what very dangerous dancing with the devil of virulent populism would do to decimate one of Canada's otherwise mainstream political parties. There was quite a bit of fretting. It's the same concern Gurney had written about 5 months prior in the column he reassessed last week. And it's the same concern most mainstream Canadian commentators have expressed ever since. So, when I read Gurney's headline, I thought, finally, they've come around. They get that the carbon tax debate wasn't in fact settled, our monetary policy wasn't above reproach, Canadians weren't okay with creeping woke culture, and the country isn't made up entirely of liberal voters willing to lend Tories their vote if only we would stop being so scary. No such luck. In fact, as I read Gurney's piece, I couldn't help but think that despite his authentic effort to do otherwise, he was largely avoiding the crux of the matter. 2 years ago, he and so many others thought our political frame was fixed. That certain issues were settled, that certain voters were locked in, and that fights for power would involve quibbling around the edges. And they weren't thinking big enough. In the end, Gurney does almost get there, but before he does, a friend and source walks him through some other, mostly irrelevant factors. They're worth exploring lest others be tempted to use them to explain their own miscalculations. First, they get into the two-year-old supply and confidence agreement between the Liberals and the NDP. The deal was a bit of a surprise, sure, but it didn't change anything. Not one iota. In fact, Canadian politics would be in an almost identical place today, had it not been struck. The NDP would still be broke, torn between trendy urban social issues and old-fashioned socialist economic policy, unable to differentiate a message track or put forward a value proposition, and propping up an unpopular government. The supply and confidence agreement isn't the single best thing that happened to Polyev, as Gurney's source put it. It's irrelevant. Next, they turn to the People's Party of Canada. Sidelining the PCC is relevant, they think, but not in the way one might expect. It's true that the PPC isn't relevant anymore, but according to them, the reason this has helped the Conservatives isn't because they can own more right-wing votes. It's because Maxime Bernier's lack of success quiets the silly Western Conservative MPs who just think the PPC could be a problem for the Conservatives. It seems not to occur to either Gurney or his source that perhaps a broad coalition that has room and respect for voters and members of parliament with right-wing views isn't an accident, but an actual strategy. And that the reason CPC MPs have stopped worrying about the PPC is because the strategy is working. After a cursory acknowledgement that maybe Polyev's early pressure on inflation has paid off, Gurney and his source turned to the big whammy, the pandemic. In short, as they would have it, O'Toole was unlucky because he had to deal with the pandemic, and Polyev's been lucky because he hasn't. But of course, Polyev did deal with the pandemic. He launched his leadership at peak insanity surrounding its fallout. Indeed, Polyev's willingness to step out on the trucker convoy and take a firm stance for personal freedoms and a return to normalcy ushered in a mainstream revolt against unreasonable restrictions. He didn't luck into the end of COVID lunacy, he practically manifested it. Finally, Gurney and his source contemplate changes in male and female voting habits. They think Gurney wasn't hip to Trudeau's waning popularity with men. True enough, but that's just another way of saying Gurney wasn't hip to changes in voting habits in general. The last year of polling has seen liberal support wane and conservative support increase across every demographic, including women of all ages. So, the question isn't why didn't people see a wave coming, it's how did they miss the tsunami? Ultimately, Gurney's source raises an observation that gets close to the truth. He tells our columnist that his analysis was too stuck in the present, or the near past. Gurney concedes that he was too biased against change, and therefore wasn't open to seeing it coming. This admission is closer to the truth, but they still don't make it all the way there. Gurney's source thinks he should have foreseen that a different conservative leader could motivate different voters on different things, thereby changing the political dynamics. This explanation would be adequate if Polyev's strategy was about suppressing his opponent's votes and motivating his own, attempting to eke out a victory through sophisticated narrowcasting and targeting, but that thinking is still too limited. Polyev's conservatives aren't just trying to motivate static voters, they've been persuading changing voters, building a coalition from the bottom up, relitigating settled policy debates, like on carbon tax and crime, and staking out new policy ground, like on drugs and DEI. Recent history is riddled with examples of conservatives thinking matters were settled and missing out on opportunity. When conservatives thought balanced budgets should be a given and matters of fiscal discipline were settled, Trudeau went about persuading the electorate that they ought to give deficits a try, and it worked for him. When Republicans became convinced they couldn't win with non-white Americans unless they had a more permissive approach to immigration, they sat on the sidelines until Trump broke the issue open again. Matters of great debate often seem very settled, until an ambitious leader comes along, makes a strong argument, and suddenly they're not again. Snark aside, I'm impressed with Gurney's willingness to interrogate his priors. Our aging, brittle commentariat would do well to take a page out of his book. Watching our 2021 YouTube livestream now, it's incredible how limited we all were in our thinking. In my efforts to convince the group that success would not come from sticking with O'Toole, I suggested, with some trepidation, that conservatives should envision victory as a big majority of seats and more than 40% of the popular vote. Everyone kind of shook their heads. To be fair, at the time I sounded naive. It's only now, in retrospect, that it doesn't seem so crazy. But that's the thing about hindsight.
That was a commentary by Ginny Roth. She is the National Practice Lead for Government Relations at Crestview Strategy. You can find the full text of her article on our website, thehub.ca. Our third essay is by Rudyard Griffiths, writing on why the government risks killing journalism and trying to save it.
Readers will have seen this week our appeal for free Hub members to become paid subscribers. Some of you might be wondering, why the push now, And why is the Hub's news and journalism deserving of my financial support? Let me explain. As our campaign is about more than the Hub, it goes to the heart of the now sweeping intrusion of government into the funding of journalism in Canada and its implications for news and information consumers like you. The largest began with the 2019 federal budget and the first ever labor tax credits for producers of written digital news. Fully $360 million was set aside over 5 years to support media outlets, not including broadcasters, who were able to convince a panel of political appointees that they were mostly engaged in the production of original news content. The subsidies were snapped up by privately owned media outlets from Canada's paper of record, the billionaire-owned The Globe and Mail, to local and regional outlets across the country. Thanks to the media's aggressive lobbying, the program was enriched to the tune of $129 million in the 2023 fall economic statement, so that qualified outlets can now claim nearly $30,000 in subsidies for every journalist they employ. Around the same time, the federal government established, and just this month renewed for 3 years, its so-called Local Journalism Initiative. This now almost $130 million program currently funds upwards of 400 journalists' salaries up to $60,000 each who cover the diverse needs of Canada's underserved communities. Participating news organizations must have or adopt a hiring policy promoting diversity and inclusion and acknowledge the government's financial support by featuring the Canada word mark in their publications. Editorial guidelines helpfully remind news publishers to display the Government of Canada wordmark in print on the front page or in the masthead, and online on the homepage. How this promotes the best traditions of an independent press capable of holding the powerful to account, including government, is frankly anyone's guess. This surge in government subsidies for the news media ratcheted up yet another notch in 2023, with the debut of the Online News Act. After a torturous legislative and regulatory setting process that prompted Meta to ultimately block news sharing on its platforms, the government was able to extract from Google a $100 million annual pledge, indexed to inflation, to fund news journalism. This time, coerced big tech, not big government, will work with a yet-defined news media association to parcel out subsidies to a smorgasbord of publishers, broadcasters, local media, First Nations and French-language media outlets, and the CBC, as prescribed by federal regulation. The Online News Act monies, combined with the recently enhanced labor tax credits, the Local Journalism Initiative, Google funding, plus tax credits for digital news subscriptions, will bring about a truly bizarre state of affairs for the news media. Fully half of the salaries of most journalists working for private companies will be paid for by, in one form or another, direct or indirect subsidies. In Quebec, thanks to a provincial tax credit, the subsidy will approach 100% of the salaries of journalists earning up to $75,000 per year. Remember that all this government largesse being heaped on private-for-profit news companies is happening alongside the CBC's $1.4 billion a year public subsidy and the massive national news operation it helps to underwrite. In sum, it is by no means a stretch to claim that in the coming year, almost all the news journalism we will consume will be produced by reporters and editors whose salaries are majority funded by one type of subsidy or another. We also know that in the next 18 months or so, there will be a federal election. It will be a high-stakes campaign with sharply different visions of the country's future on offer. And it will be fought for the first time in an information environment where the majority of the salaries of most news journalists, including at private media outlets, will be subsidized by the policies of the party in power. To state the obvious, we, the news media, are facing an own goal of epic proportions. Specifically, how do we think the only 37% of English-speaking Canadians who say they trust the press are likely to react when they suss out that almost all the news they are consuming is directly or indirectly government-subsidized? Will they be more or less likely to trust us? Will they take our reporting as factual or government-funded spin? The complicity of silence of the news industry on these questions, ones that go to the core of what the profession of journalism is supposedly all about, is as appalling as it is inexcusable. Editors and journalists will protest that they aren't corrupted by the government's lucre, and for most, this will be true. But we live in an age of conspiracy theories, disinformation, and bad faith actors. All three will ensure that government-subsidized news journalism at scale becomes something far less than what our democracy urgently needs: truly independent, arm's-length reporting. There is a good faith argument we've encouraged at the Hub about whether news journalism is a public good that merits government support in a moment of sweeping technological disruption. But assuming that conspicuous rent seeking from government by private news providers is consequence-free strains credulity. Instead of saving journalism, the blind rush to subsidize news gathering risks destroying what little remains of the industry's credibility. As The Hub enters its fourth year of publication and starts gearing up to cover the coming federal election, we are purposely choosing to hoe a harder row than the mainstream media, producing original news journalism not funded by the current subsidy regime. In the process, we will turn down hundreds of thousands of dollars in potential government subsidies because we cannot in good conscience take these funds and claim to be truly independent. This is why we are now asking you, our 25,000-plus free subscribers, to become paid supporters of our news journalism. It's your generosity that helps us hire fiercely independent reporters and editors who know their salaries are paid for by readers like you and not by the incumbent government and its policies.
That was a commentary by Rudyard Griffiths, The Hub's executive director. That's it for today's edition of Hub Headlines. We hope you enjoyed the program. To receive all our best commentary and analysis each morning by email, subscribe to The Hub for as little as 25 cents a day. You can do that right now at thehub.ca. Hub Headlines is produced by Alicia Rao. Thanks for listening.